was ready to hoist sail as soon as the Republic had received the price of the freight and armament. But that price far exceeded the wealth of the crusaders who were assembled at Venice. The Flemings, whose obedience to their count was voluntary and precarious, had embarked in their vessels for the long navigation of the ocean and Mediterranean, and many of the French and Italians had preferred a cheaper and more convenient passage from Marseille and Apulia to the Holy Land. Each pilgrim might complain that after he had furnished his own contribution, he was made responsible for the deficiency of his absent brethren. The gold and silver plate of the chiefs, which they freely delivered to the treasury of St. Mark's, was a generous but inadequate sacrifice. And after all their efforts, 34,000 marks were still wanting to complete the stipulated sum. The obstacle was removed by the policy and patriotism of the Doge, who proposed to the barons that if they would join their arms in reducing some revolted cities of Dalmatia, he would expose his person in the Holy War and obtain from the Republic a long indulgence till some wealthy conquest should afford the means of satisfying the debt. After much scruple and hesitation, they chose rather to accept the offer than to relinquish the enterprise, and the first hostilities of the fleet and army were directed against Zara, a strong city of the Sclavonian coast, which had renounced its allegiance to Venice and implored the protection of the King of Hungary. The crusaders burst the chain or boom of the harbour, landed their horses, troops, and military engines, and compelled the inhabitants, after a defense of 5 days, to surrender at discretion. Their lives were spared, but the revolt was punished by the pillage of their houses and the demolition of their walls. The season was far advanced. The French and Venetians resolved to pass the winter in a secure harbor and plentiful country, but their repose was disturbed by national and tumultuous quarrels of the soldiers and mariners. The conquest of Zara had scattered the seeds of discord and scandal. The arms of the allies had been stained in their outset with the blood not of infidels, but of Christians. The King of Hungary and his new subjects were themselves enlisted under the banner of the cross, and the scruples of the devout were magnified by the fear of lassitude of the reluctant pilgrims. The Pope had excommunicated the false crusaders who had pillaged and massacred their brethren, and only the Marquis Boniface and Simon of Montfort escaped these spiritual thunders, the one by his absence from the siege, the other by his final departure from the camp. Innocent might absolve the simple and submissive penitents of France, but he was provoked by the stubborn reason of the Venetians, who refused to confess their guilt, to accept their pardon, or to allow in their temporal concerns the interposition of a priest. The assembly of such formidable powers by sea and land had revived the hopes of young Alexius, and both at Venice and Zara he solicited the arms of the crusaders for his own restoration and his father's deliverance. The royal youth was recommended by Philip, King of Germany. His prayers and presence excited the compassion of the camp, and his cause was embraced and pleaded by the Marquis of Montferrat and the Doge of Venice. A double alliance and the dignity of Caesar had connected with the imperial family the two elder brothers of Boniface. He expected to derive a kingdom from the important service, and the more generous ambition of Dondolo was eager to secure the inestimable benefits of trade and dominion that might accrue to his country. Their influence procured a favorable audience for the ambassadors of Alexius, and if the magnitude of his offers excited some suspicion, the motives and rewards which he displayed might justify the delay and diversion of those forces which had been consecrated to the deliverance of Jerusalem. He promised in his own and his father's name that as soon as they should be seated on the throne of Constantinople, they would terminate the long schism of the Greeks and submit themselves and their people to the lawful supremacy of the Roman Church. He engaged to recompense the labors and merits of the Crusaders by the immediate payment of 200,000 marks of silver, to accompany them in person to Egypt, or, if it should be judged more advantageous, to maintain, during a year, 10,000 men, and during his life, 500 knights for the service of the Holy Land. These tempting conditions were accepted by the Republic of Venice, and the eloquence of the Doge and Marquis persuaded the Counts of Flanders, Blois, and St. Paul, with 8 barons of France, to join in the glorious enterprise. A treaty of offensive and defensive alliance was confirmed by their oaths and seals, and each individual, according to his situation and character, was swayed by the hope of public or private advantage, by the honour of restoring an exiled monarch, or by the sincere and probable opinion that their efforts in Palestine would be fruitless and unavailing, and that the acquisition of Constantinople must precede and prepare the recovery of Jerusalem. But they were the chiefs or equals of a valiant band of freemen and volunteers who thought and acted for themselves. The soldiers and clergy were divided, and if a large majority subscribed to the alliance, the numbers and arguments of the dissidents were strong and respectable. The boldest hearts were appalled by the report of the naval power and impregnable strength of Constantinople, and their apprehensions were disguised to the world, and perhaps to themselves, by the more decent objections of religion and duty. They alleged the sanctity of a vow which had drawn them from their families and homes to the rescue of the Holy Sepulchre, nor should the dark and crooked counsels of human policy divert them from a pursuit, the event of which was in the hands of the Almighty. Their first offence, the attack of Zara, had been severely punished by the reproach of their conscience and the censures of the Pope. Nor would they, again, imbrue their hands in the blood of their fellow Christians. The Apostle of Rome had pronounced, nor would they usurp the right of avenging with the sword the schism of the Greeks and the doubtful usurpation of the Byzantine monarch. On these principles or pretenses, many pilgrims, the most distinguished for their valor and piety, withdrew from the camp, and their retreat was less pernicious than the open or secret opposition of a discontented party that labored on every occasion to separate the army and disappoint the enterprise. Notwithstanding this defection, the departure of the fleet and army was vigorously pressed by the Venetians, whose zeal for the service of the royal youth concealed a just resentment to his nation and family. They were mortified by the recent preference which had been given to Pisa, the rival of their trade. They had a long arrear of debt and injury to liquidate with the Byzantine court, and Dondolo might not discourage the popular tale that he had been deprived of his eyes by the Emperor Manuel, who perfidiously violated the sanctity of an ambassador. A similar armament, for ages, had not rowed the Adriatic. It was composed of 120 flat-bottomed vessels, or palandas, for the horses, 240 transports filled with men and arms, 70 storeships laden with provisions, and 50 stout galleys well prepared for the encounter of an enemy. While the wind was favorable, the sky serene, and the wind smooth, every eye was fixed with wonder and delight on the scene of military and naval pomp which overspread the sea. The shields of the knights and squires, at once an ornament and a defense, were arranged on either side of the ships. The banners of the nations and families were displayed from the stern. Our modern artillery was supplied by 300 engines for casting stones and darts. The fatigues of the way were cheered with the sound of music, and the spirits of the adventurers were raised by the mutual assurance that 40,000 Christian heroes were equal to the conquest of the world. In the navigation from Venice and Zara, the fleet was successfully steered by the skill and experience of the Venetian pilots. At Durazzo, the Confederates first landed on the territories of the Greek Empire. The Isle of Corfu afforded a station and repose. They doubled, without accident, the perilous Cape of Malea, the southern point of Peloponnesus or the Morea, made a descent in the islands of Negropont and Andros, and cast anchor at Abydos on the Asiatic side of the Hellespont. These preludes of conquest were easy and bloodless. The Greeks of the provinces, without patriotism or courage, were crushed by an irresistible force. The presence of the lawful heir might justify their obedience, and it was rewarded by the modesty and discipline of the Latins. As they penetrated through the Hellespont, the magnitude of their navy was compressed in a narrow channel, and the face of the waters was darkened with innumerable sails. They again expanded in the basin of the Propontis and traversed that placid sea till they approached the European shore at the Abbey of St. Stephen, 3 leagues to the west of Constantinople. The prudent Doge dissuaded them from dispersing themselves in a populous and hostile land, and as their stock of provisions was reduced, it was resolved in the season of harvest to replenish their storeships in the fertile islands of the Propontis. With this resolution, they directed their course, but a strong gale and their own impatience drove them to the eastward. And so near did they run to the shore and the city that some volleys of stones and darts were exchanged between the ships and the rampart. As they passed along, they gazed with admiration on the capital of the East, or, as it should seem, of the Earth, rising from her 7 hills and towering over the continents of Europe and Asia. The swelling domes and lofty spires of 500 palaces and churches were gilded by the sun and reflected in the waters. The walls were crowded with soldiers and spectators, whose numbers they beheld, of whose temper they were ignorant, and each heart was chilled by the reflection that since the beginning of the world, such an enterprise had never been undertaken by such a handful of warriors. But the momentary apprehension was dispelled by hope and valor, that every man, says the Marshal of Champagne, glanced his eye on the sword or lance which he must speedily use in the glorious conflict. The Latins cast anchor before Chalcedon. The mariners only were left in the vessels. The soldiers, horses, and arms were safely landed, and in the luxury of an imperial palace the barons tasted the first fruits of their success. On the 3rd day the fleet and army moved towards Scutari, the Asiatic suburb of Constantinople. A detachment of 500 Greek horse was surprised and defeated by 40 French knights, and in a halt of 9 days the camp was plentifully supplied with forage and provisions. In relating the invasion of a great empire, it may seem strange that I have not described the obstacles which should have checked the progress of the strangers. The Greeks, in truth, were an unwarlike people, but they were rich, industrious, and subject to the will of a single man. Had that man been capable of fear when his enemies were at a distance, or of courage when they approached his person? The first rumor of his nephew's alliance with the French and Venetians was despised by the usurper Alexius. His flatterers persuaded him that in this contempt he was bold and sincere. And each evening, in the close of the banquet, he thrice discomfited the barbarians of the West. These barbarians had been justly terrified by the report of his naval power, and the 1,600 fishing boats of Constantinople could have manned a fleet to sink them in the Adriatic, or stopped their entrance in the mouth of the Hellespont. but all force may be annihilated by the negligence of the prince and the venality of his ministers. The great duke or admiral made a scandalous, almost a public auction of the sails, the masts, and the rigging. The royal forests were reserved for the more important purpose of the chase. And the trees, says Nicetas, were guarded by the eunuchs, like the groves of religious worship. From his dream of pride, Alexius was awakened by the siege of Zara and the rapid advances of the Latins. As soon as he saw the danger was real, he thought it inevitable, and his vain presumption was lost in abject despondency and despair. He suffered these contemptible barbarians to pitch their camp in the sight of the palace, and his apprehensions were thinly disguised by the pomp and menace of a suppliant embassy. The sovereign of the Romans was astonished, his ambassadors were instructed to say, at the hostile appearance of the strangers. If these pilgrims were sincere in their vow for the deliverance of Jerusalem, his voice must applaud, and his treasures should assist their pious design. But should they dare to invade the sanctuary of empire, their numbers, were they 10 times more considerable, should not protect them from his just resentment. The answer of the Doge and barons was simple and magnanimous. In the cause of honor and justice, they said, we despise the usurper of Greece, his threats, and his offers. Our friendship and his allegiance are due to the lawful heir, to the young prince who is seated among us, and to his father, the Emperor Isaac, who has been deprived of his scepter, his freedom, and his eyes by the crime of an ungrateful brother. Let that brother confess his guilt and implore forgiveness, and we ourselves will intercede that he may be permitted to live in affluence and security. But let him not insult us by a second message. Our reply will be made in arms in the palace of Constantinople. On the 10th day of their encampment at Scutari, the crusaders prepared themselves, as soldiers and as Catholics, for the passage of the Bosphorus. Perilous indeed was the adventure. The stream was broad and rapid. In a calm, the current of the Black Sea might drive down the liquid and unextinguishable fires of the Greeks, and the opposite shores of Europe were defended by 70,000 horse and foot in formidable array. On this memorable day, which happened to be bright and pleasant, the Latins were distributed in 6 battles or divisions. The first, or vanguard, was led by the Count of Flanders, one of the most powerful of the Christian princes in the skill and number of his crossbows. The 4 successive battles of the French were commanded by his brother Henry, the Counts of St. Paul and Blois and Matthew of Montmorency, the last of whom was honored by the voluntary service of the Marshal and Nobles of Champagne. The 6th Division, the rearguard and reserve of the army, was conducted by the Marquis of Montferrat, at the head of the Germans and Lombards. The chargers, saddled with their long caparisons dragging on the ground, were embarked in the flat palanders, and the knights stood on the side of their horses in complete armor, their helmets laced, and their lances in their hands. The numerous train of sergeants and archers occupied the transports, and each transport was towed by the strength and swiftness of a galley. The 6 divisions traversed the Bosphorus without encountering an enemy or an obstacle. To land the foremost was the wish. To conquer or die was the resolution of every division and of every soldier. Jealous of the preeminence of danger, the knights in their heavy armor leaped into the sea when it rose as high as their girdle. The sergeants and archers were animated by their valor, and the squires, letting down the drawbridges of the palanders, led the horses to the shore. Before their squadrons could mount and form and couch their lances, the 70,000 Greeks had vanished from their sight. The timid Alexius gave the example to his troops, and it was only by the plunder of his rich pavilions that the Latins were informed that they had fought against an emperor. In the first consternation of the flying enemy, they resolved, by double attack, to open the entrance of the harbour. The tower of Galata, in the suburb of Pera, was attacked and stormed by the French, while the Venetians assumed the more difficult task of forcing the boom or chain that was stretched from that tower to the Byzantine shore. After some fruitless attempts, their intrepid perseverance prevailed. 20 ships of war, the relics of the Grecian navy, were either sunk or taken. The enormous and massy links of iron were cut asunder by the shears or broken by the weight of the galleys, and the Venetian fleet, safe and triumphant, rode at anchor in the port of Constantinople. By these daring achievements, a remnant of 20,000 Latins solicited the license of besieging a capital which contained above 400,000 inhabitants, able, though not willing, to bear arms in defense of their country. Such an account would indeed suppose a population of near 2 millions. But whatever abatement may be required in the numbers of the Greeks, the belief of those numbers will equally exalt the fearless spirit of their assailants. In the choice of the attack, the French and Venetians were divided by their habits of life and warfare. The former affirmed with truth that Constantinople was most accessible on the side of the sea and the harbour. The latter might assert with honour that they had long enough trusted their lives and fortunes to a frail bark and a precarious element, and loudly demanded a trial of knighthood, a firm ground, and a close onset, either on foot or on horseback. After a prudent compromise of employing the two nations by sea and land in the service best suited to their character, the fleet covering the army, they both proceeded from the entrance to the extremity of the harbour. The stone bridge of the river was hastily repaired, and the 6 battles of the French formed their encampment against the front of the capital, the basis of the triangle which runs about 4 miles from the port to the Propontis. On the edge of a broad ditch, at the foot of a lofty rampart, they had leisure to contemplate the difficulties of their enterprise. The gates to the right and left of their narrow camp poured forth frequent sallies of cavalry and light infantry, which cut off their stragglers, swept the country of provisions, sounded the alarm 5 or 6 times in the course of each day, and compelled them to plant a palisade and sink an entrenchment for their immediate safety. In the supplies and convoys, the Venetians had been too sparing, or the Franks too voracious. The usual complaints of hunger and scarcity were heard, and perhaps felt. Their stocks of flour would be exhausted in 3 weeks, and their disgust of salt meat tempted them to taste the flesh of their horses. The trembling usurper was supported by Theodore Lascaris, his son-in-law, a valiant youth who aspired to save and to rule his country. The Greeks, regardless of that country, were awakened to the defense of their religion, but their firmest hope was in the strength and spirit of the Varangian guards, of the Danes and English, as they are named in the writers of the times. After 10 days' incessant labor, the ground was leveled, the ditch filled, the approaches of the besiegers were regularly made, and 250 engines of assault exercised their various powers to clear the rampart, to batter the walls, and to sap the foundations. On the first appearance of a breach, the scaling ladders were applied. The numbers that defended the vantage ground repulsed and oppressed the adventurous Latins, but they admired the resolution of 15 knights and sergeants who had gained the ascent and maintained their perilous station till they were precipitated or made prisoners by the imperial guards. On the side of the harbour, the naval attack was more successfully conducted by the Venetians, and that industrious people employed every resource that was known and practiced before the invention of gunpowder. A double line, 3 bow shots in front, was formed by the galleys and ships, and the swift motion of the former was supported by the weight and loftiness of the latter, whose decks and poops and turrets were the platforms of military engines that discharged their shot over the heads of the first line. The soldiers who leaped from the galleys on shore immediately planted and ascended their scaling ladders, while the large ships, advancing more slowly into the intervals and lowering a drawbridge, opened a way through the air from their masts to the rampart. In the midst of the conflict, the Doge, a venerable and conspicuous form, stood aloft in complete armor on the prow of his galley. The great standard of St. Mark was displayed before him. His threats, promises, and exhortations urged the diligence of the rowers. His vessel was the first that struck, and Dandolo was the first warrior on the shore. The nations admired the magnanimity of the blind old man, without reflecting that his age and infirmities diminished the price of life and enhanced the value of immortal glory. On a sudden, by an invisible hand, for the standard-bearer was probably slain, the banner of the Republic was fixed on the rampart. 25 towers were rapidly occupied, and by the cruel expedient of fire, the Greeks were driven from the adjacent quarter. The Doge had dispatched the intelligence of his success when he was checked by the danger of his confederates. Nobly declaring that he would rather die with the pilgrims than gain a victory by their destruction, Dandolo relinquished his advantage, recalled his troops, and hastened to the scene of action. He found the 6 weary, diminutive battles of the French encompassed by 60 squadrons of the Greek cavalry, the least of which was more numerous than the largest of their divisions. Shame and despair had provoked Alexius to the last effort of a general sally, but he was awed by the firm order and manly aspect of the Latins, and after skirmishing at a distance, withdrew his troops in the close of the evening. The silence or tumult of the night exasperated his fears, and the timid usurper, collecting a treasure of 10,000 pounds of gold, basely deserted his wife, his people, and his fortune, threw himself into a bark, stole through the Bosphorus, and landed in shameful safety in an obscure harbour of Thrace. As soon as they were apprised of his flight, the Greek nobles sought pardon and peace in the dungeon where the blind Isaac expected each hour the visit of the executioner. Again saved and exalted by the vicissitudes of fortune, the captive in his imperial robes was replaced on the throne, and surrounded with prostrate slaves, whose real terror and affected joy he was incapable of discerning. At the dawn of day, hostilities were suspended, and the Latin chiefs were surprised by a message from the lawful and reigning emperor, who was impatient to embrace his son and to reward his generous deliverers. But these generous deliverers were unwilling to release their hostage till they had obtained from his father the payment, or at least the promise of their recompense. They chose 4 ambassadors, Matthew of Montmorency, our historian, the Marshal of Champagne, and 2 Venetians to congratulate the emperor. The gates were thrown open on their approach. The streets on both sides were lined with the battle axes of the Danish and English guard. The presence chamber glittered with gold and jewels, the false substitute of virtue and power. By the side of the blind Isaac, his wife was seated, the sister of the King of Hungary. And by her appearance, the noble matrons of Greece were drawn from their domestic retirement and mingled with the circle of senators and soldiers. The Latins, by the mouth of the marshal, spoke like men conscious of their merits, but who respected the work of their own hands. And the emperor clearly understood that his son's engagements with Venice and the pilgrims must be ratified without hesitation or delay. Withdrawing into a private chamber with the empress, a chamberlain, an interpreter, and the four ambassadors, the father of young Alexius, inquired with some anxiety into the nature of his stipulations. The submission of the Eastern Empire to the Pope, the succor of the Holy Land, and a present contribution of 200,000 marks of silver. These conditions are weighty, was his prudent reply. They are hard to accept and difficult to perform, but no conditions can exceed the measure of your services and deserts. After this satisfactory assurance, the barons mounted on horseback and introduced the heir of Constantinople to the city and palace. His youth and marvelous adventures engaged every heart in his favor, and Alexius was solemnly crowned with his father in the dome of Santa Sophia. In the first days of his reign, the people, already blessed with the restoration of plenty and peace, was delighted by the joyful catastrophe of the tragedy. And the discontent of the nobles, their regret, and their fears were covered by the polished surface of pleasure and loyalty. The mixture of two discordant nations in the same capital might have been pregnant with mischief and danger, and the suburb of Galata or Pera was assigned for the quarters of the French and Venetians. But the liberty of trade and familiar intercourse was allowed between the friendly nations, and each day the pilgrims were tempted by devotion or curiosity to visit the churches and palaces of Constantinople. Their rude minds, insensible perhaps of the finer arts, were astonished by the magnificent scenery, and the poverty of their native towns enhanced the populousness and riches of the first metropolis of Christendom. Descending from his state, young Alexius was prompted by interest and gratitude to repeat his frequent and familiar visits to his Latin allies, and in the freedom of the table, the gay petulance of the French sometimes forgot the Emperor of the East. In their most serious conferences, it was agreed that the union of the two churches must be the result of patience and time. But avarice was less tractable than zeal, and a large sum was instantly disbursed to appease the wants and silence the importunity of the crusaders. Alexius was alarmed by the approaching hour of their departure. Their absence might have relieved him from the engagement which he was yet incapable of performing, but his friends would have left him, naked and alone, to the caprice and prejudice of a perfidious nation. He wished to bribe their stay, the delay of a year, by undertaking to defray their expense and to satisfy, in their name, the freight of the Venetian vessels. The offer was agitated in the council of the barons, and after a repetition of their debates and scruples, a majority of votes again acquiesced in the advice of the Doge and the prayer of the young emperor. At the price of 1,600 pounds of gold, he prevailed on the Marquis of Montferrat to lead him with an army round the provinces of Europe, to establish his authority and pursue his uncle, while Constantinople was awed by the presence of Baldwin and his confederates of France and Flanders. The expedition was successful. The blind emperor exulted in the success of his arms and listened to the predictions of his flatterers that the same providence which had raised him from the dungeon to the throne would heal his gout, restore his sight, and watch over the long prosperity of his reign. Yet the mind of the suspicious old man was tormented by the rising glories of his son. Nor could his pride conceal from his envy that while his own name was pronounced in faint and reluctant acclamations, the royal youth was the theme of spontaneous and universal praise. By the recent invasion, the Greeks were awakened from a dream of 9 centuries, from the vain presumption that the capital of the Roman Empire was impregnable to foreign arms. The strangers of the West had violated the city and bestowed the scepter of Constantine. Their imperial clients soon became as unpopular as themselves. The well-known vices of Isaac were rendered still more contemptible by his infirmities, and the young Alexius was hated as an apostate who had renounced the manners and religion of his country. His secret covenant with the Latins was divulged or suspected. The people, and especially the clergy, were devoutly attached to their faith and superstition, and every convent and every shop resounded with the danger of the church and the tyranny of the Pope. An empty treasury could ill supply the demands of regal luxury and foreign extortion. The Greeks refused to avert, by general tax, the impending evils of servitude and pillage. The oppression of the rich excited a more dangerous and personal resentment. And if the emperor melted the plate and despoiled the images of the sanctuary, he seemed to justify the complaints of heresy and sacrilege. During the absence of Marquis Boniface and his imperial pupil, Constantinople was visited with a calamity which might be justly imputed to the zeal and indiscretion of the Flemish pilgrims. In one of their visits to the city, they were scandalized by the aspect of a mosque or synagogue in which one god was worshipped without a partner or a son. Their effectual mode of controversy was to attack the infidels with the sword and their habitation with fire. But the infidels and some Christian neighbors presumed to defend their lives and properties, and the flames which bigotry had kindled consumed the most orthodox and innocent structures. During 8 days and nights, the conflagration spread above a league in front, from the harbor to the Propontis, over the thickest and most populous regions of the city. It is not easy to count the stately churches and palaces that were reduced to a smoking ruin, to value the merchandise that perished in the trading streets, or to number the families that were involved in the common destruction. By this outrage, which the Doge and the barons in vain affected to disclaim, the name of the Latins became still more unpopular, and the colony of that nation, above 15,000 persons, consulted their safety in a hasty retreat from the city to the protection of their standard in the suburb of Pera. The emperor returned in triumph, but the firmest and most dexterous policy would have been insufficient to steer him through the tempest, which overwhelmed one person and government of that unhappy youth. His own inclination and his father's advice attached him to his benefactors. But Alexius hesitated between gratitude and patriotism, between the fear of his subjects and of his allies. By his feeble and fluctuating conduct, he lost the esteem and confidence of both, and while he invited the Marquis of Montferrat to occupy the palace, he suffered the nobles to conspire and the people to arm for the deliverance of their country. Regardless of his painful situation, the Latin chiefs repeated their demands, resented his delays, suspected his intentions, and exacted a decisive answer of peace or war. The haughty summons was delivered by 3 French knights and 3 Venetian deputies, who girded their swords, mounted their horses, pierced through the angry multitude, and entered with a fearful countenance the palace and presence of the Greek emperor. In a peremptory tone, they recapitulated their services and his engagements, and boldly declared that unless their just claims were fully and immediately satisfied, they should no longer hold him either as a sovereign or a friend. After this defiance, the first that had ever wounded an imperial ear, they departed without betraying any symptoms of fear. But their escape from a servile palace and a furious city astonished the ambassadors themselves, and their return to the camp was the signal of mutual hostility. Among the Greeks, all authority and wisdom were overborne by the impetuous multitude, who mistook their rage for valor, their numbers for strength, and their fanaticism for the support and inspiration of heaven. In the eyes of both nations, Alexius was false and contemptible. The base and spurious race of the Angeli was rejected with clamorous disdain, and the people of Constantinople encompassed the Senate to demand at their hands a more worthy emperor. To every senator, conspicuous by his birth or dignity, they successively presented the purple. By each senator the deadly garment was repulsed. The contest lasted 3 days, and we may learn from the historian Nicetas, one of the members of the assembly, that fear and weaknesses were the guardians of their loyalty. A phantom who vanished in oblivion was forcibly proclaimed by the crowd. But the author of the tumult and the leader of the war was a prince of the House of Ducas, and his common appellation of Alexius must be discriminated by the epithet of Mourzoufle, which in the vulgar idiom expressed the close junction of his black and shaggy eyebrows. At once a patriot and a courtier, the perfidious Mourzoufle, who was not destitute of cunning and courage, opposed the Latins both in speech and action, inflamed the passions and prejudices of the Greeks, and insinuated himself into the favour and confidence of Alexius, who trusted him with the office of Great Chamberlain, and tinged his buskins with the colours of royalty. At the dead of night, he rushed into the bedchamber with an affrighted aspect, exclaiming that the palace was attacked by the people and betrayed by the guards. Starting from his couch, the unsuspecting prince threw himself into the arms of his enemy, who had contrived his escape by private staircase. But that staircase terminated in a prison. Alexius was seized, stripped, and loaded with chains, and after tasting some days the bitterness of death, he was poisoned, or strangled, or beaten with clubs, at the command or in the presence of the tyrant. The emperor Isaac Angelus soon followed his son to the grave, and Mourzoufle, perhaps, might spare the superfluous crime of hastening the extinction of impotence and blindness. The death of the emperors and the usurpation of Mourzoufle had changed the nature of the quarrel. It was no longer the disagreement of allies who overvalued their services or neglected their obligations. The French and Venetians forgot their complaints against Alexius, dropped a tear on the untimely fate of their companion, and swore revenge against the perfidious nation who had crowned his assassin. Yet the prudent Doge was still inclined to negotiate. He asked, as a debt, a subsidy or a fine, 50,000 pounds of gold, about 2 million sterling. Nor would the conference have been abruptly broken if the zeal or policy of Mourzoufle had not refused to sacrifice the Greek church to the safety of the state. Amidst the invectives of his foreign and domestic enemies, we may discern that he was not unworthy of the character which he had assumed of the public champion. The second siege of Constantinople was far more laborious than the first. The treasury was replenished, and discipline was restored by a severe inquisition into the abuses of the former reign. And Mourzoufle, an iron mace in his hand, visiting the posts and affecting the port and aspect of a warrior, was an object of terror to his soldiers, at least, and to his kinsmen. Before and after the death of Alexius, the Greeks made 2 vigorous and well-conducted attempts to burn the navy in the harbour. But the skill and courage of the Venetians repulsed the fireships, and the vagrant flames wasted themselves without injury in the sea. In a nocturnal sally, the Greek emperor was vanquished by Henry, brother of the Count of Flanders. The advantages of number and surprise aggravated the shame of his defeat. His buckler was found on the field of battle, and the imperial standard, a divine image of the Virgin, was presented as a trophy and a relic to the Cistercian monks, the disciples of Saint Bernard. Near 3 months, without excepting the holy season of Lent, were consumed in skirmishes and preparations before the Latins were ready or resolved for a general assault. The land fortifications had been found impregnable, and the Venetian pilots represented that on the shore of the Propontis the anchorage was unsafe, and the ships must be driven by the current far away to the straits of the Hellespont. A prospect not unpleasing to the reluctant pilgrims, who sought every opportunity of breaking the army. From the harbour, therefore, the assault was determined by the assailants, and expected by the besieged, and the emperor had placed his scarlet pavilions on a neighbouring height to direct and animate the efforts of his troops. A fearless spectator, whose mind could entertain the ideas of pomp and pleasure, might have admired the long array of two embattled armies which extended above half a league, the one on the ships and galleys, the other on the walls and towers raised above the ordinary level by several stages of wooden turrets. Their first fury was spent in the discharge of darts, stones, and fire from the engines. But the water was deep. The French were bold. The Venetians were skillful. They approached the walls, and a desperate conflict of swords, spears, and battle-axes was fought on the trembling bridges that grappled the floating, to the stable, batteries. In more than 100 places the assault was urged, and the defense was sustained, till the superiority of ground and numbers finally prevailed, and the Latin trumpets sounded a retreat. On the ensuing days the attack was renewed with equal vigor, and a similar event. And in the night the Doge and the barons held a council, apprehensive only for the public danger. Not a voice pronounced the words of escape or treaty, and each warrior, according to his temper, embraced the hope of victory or the assurance of a glorious death. By the experience of the former siege, the Greeks were instructed, but the Latins were animated. And the knowledge that Constantinople might be taken was of more avail than the local precautions which that knowledge had inspired for its defense. In the third assault, two ships were linked together to double their strength. A strong north wind drove them on the shore. The Bishop of Troy and Soissons led the van, and the auspicious names of the Pilgrim and the Paradise resounded along the line. The episcopal banners were displayed on the walls. 100 marks of silver had been promised to the first adventurers, and if their reward was intercepted by death, their names have been immortalized by fame. 4 towers were scaled, 3 gates were burst open, and the French knights, who might tremble on the waves, felt themselves invincible on horseback on the solid ground. Shall I relate that the thousands who guarded the emperor's person fled on the approach, and before the lance of a single warrior? Their ignominious flight is attested by their countryman Nicetas. An army of phantoms marched with the French hero, and he was magnified to a giant in the eyes of the Greeks. While the fugitives deserted their posts and cast away their arms, the Latins entered the city under the banners of their leaders. The streets and gates opened for their passage, and either design or accident kindled a third conflagration, which consumed, in a few hours, the measure of 3 of the largest cities of France. In the close of evening, the barons checked their troops and fortified their stations. They were awed by the extent and populousness of the capital, which might yet require the labor of a month if the churches and palaces were conscious of their internal strength. But in the morning a suppliant procession with crosses and images announced the submission of the Greeks and deprecated the wrath of the conquerors. The usurper escaped through the Golden Gate. The palaces of Blakerny and Bucolion were occupied by the Count of Flanders and the Marquis of Montferrat, and the empire, which still bore the name of Constantine and the title of Roman, was subverted by the arms of the Latin pilgrims. Constantinople had been taken by storm, and no restraints, except those of religion and humanity, were imposed on the conquerors by the laws of war. Boniface, Marquis of Montferrat, still acted as their general, and the Greeks, who revered his name as that of the future sovereign, were heard to exclaim in a lamentable tone, "Holy Marquis King, have mercy upon us." His prudence or compassion opened the gates of the city to the fugitives, and he exhorted the soldiers of the cross to spare the lives of their fellow Christians. The streams of blood that flowed down the pages of Nicetas may be reduced to the slaughter of 2,000 of his unresisting countrymen, and the greater part was massacred not by the strangers, but by the Latins, who had been driven from the city and who exercised the revenge of a triumphant faction. Yet of these exiles, some were less mindful of injuries than of benefits. And Nicetas himself was indebted for his safety to the generosity of a Venetian merchant. Pope Innocent III accuses the pilgrims for respecting, in their lust, neither age nor sex nor religious profession, and bitterly laments that the deeds of darkness, fornication, adultery, and incest were perpetrated in open day, and that noble matrons and holy nuns were polluted by the grooms and peasants of the Catholic camp. It is indeed probable that the license of victory prompted and covered a multitude of sins, but it is certain that the capital of the East contained a stock of venal or willing beauty sufficient to satiate the desires of 20,000 pilgrims, and female prisoners were no longer subject to the right or abuse of domestic slavery. The Marquis of Montferrat was the patron of discipline and decency. The Count of Flanders was the mirror of chastity. They had forbidden, under pain of death, the rape of married women or virgins or nuns, and the proclamation was sometimes invoked by the vanquished and respected by the victors. Their cruelty and lust were moderated by the authority of the chiefs and feelings of the soldiers, for we are no longer describing an eruption of the northern savages, and however ferocious they might still appear, time, policy, and religion had civilized the manners of the French, and still more of the Italians. But a free scope was allowed to their avarice, which was glutted, even in the Holy Week, by the pillage of Constantinople. The right of victory, unshackled by any promise or treaty, had confiscated the public and private wealth of the Greeks, and every hand, according to its size and strength, might lawfully execute the sentence and seize the forfeiture. A portable and universal standard of exchange was found in the coined and uncoined metals of gold and silver, which each captor, at home or abroad, might convert into the possessions most suitable to his temper and situation. Of the treasures which trade and luxury had accumulated, the silks, velvets, furs, the gems, spices, and rich movables were the most precious, as they could not be procured for money in the ruder countries of Europe. An order of rapine was instituted, nor was the share of each individual abandoned to industry or chance. Under the tremendous penalties of perjury, excommunication, and death, the Latins were bound to deliver their plunder into the common stock. Three churches were selected for the deposit and distribution of the spoil. A single share was allotted to a foot soldier, two for a sergeant on horseback, four to a knight, and larger proportions according to the rank and merit of the barons and princes. For violating this sacred engagement, a knight belonging to the Count of St. Paul was hanged with his shield and coat of arms round his neck. His example might render similar offenders more artful and discreet, but avarice was more powerful than fear, and it is generally believed that the secret far exceeded the acknowledged plunder. Yet the magnitude of the prize surpassed the largest scale of experience or expectation. After the whole had been equally divided between the French and Venetians, 50,000 marks were deducted to satisfy the debts of the former and the demands of the latter. The residue of the French amounted to 400,000 marks of silver, about 800,000 pounds sterling. Nor can I better appreciate the value of that sum in the public and private transactions of the age than by defining it as 7 times the annual revenue of the Kingdom of England. In this great revolution, we enjoy the singular felicity of comparing the narratives of Villehardouin and Nicetas, the opposite feelings of the Marshal of Champagne and the Byzantine senator. At the first view, it should seem that the wealth of Constantinople was only transferred from one nation to another, and that the loss and sorrow of the Greeks is exactly balanced by the joy and advantage of the Latins. But in the miserable account of war, the gain is never equivalent to the loss, the pleasure to the pain. The smiles of the Latins were transient and fallacious. the Greeks forever wept over the ruins of their country, and their real calamities were aggravated by sacrilege and mockery. What benefits accrued to the conquerors from the three fires which annihilated so vast a portion of the buildings and riches of the city? What a stock of such things as could neither be used nor transported was maliciously or wantonly destroyed. How much treasure was idly wasted in gaming, debauchery, and riot? And what precious objects were bartered for a vile price by the impatience or ignorance of the soldiers, whose reward was stolen by the base industry of the last of the Greeks? These alone, who had nothing to lose, might derive some profit from the revolution. But the misery of the upper ranks of society is strongly painted in the personal adventures of Nicetas himself. His stately palace had been reduced to ashes in the second conflagration, and the senator, with his family and friends, found an obscure shelter in another house which he possessed near the church of Santa Sophia. It was the door of this mean habitation that his friend, the Venetian merchant, guarded in the disguise of a soldier, till Nicetas could save, by precipitate flight, the relics of his fortune and the chastity of his daughter. In a cold, wintry season, these fugitives, nursed in the lap of prosperity, departed on foot. His wife was with child. The desertion of their slaves compelled them to carry their baggage on their own shoulders, and their women, whom they placed in the center, were exhorted to conceal their beauty with dirt, instead of adorning it with paint and jewels. Every step was exposed to insult and danger. The threats of the strangers were less painful than the taunts of the plebeians, with whom they were now leveled. Nor did the exiles breathe in safety till their mournful pilgrimage was concluded at Sclimbria, above 40 miles from the capital. On the way they overtook the patriarch, without attendants and almost without apparel, riding on an ass, and reduced to a state of apostolical poverty which, had it been voluntary, might perhaps have been meritorious. In the meanwhile, his desolate churches were profaned by the licentiousness and party zeal of the Latins. After stripping the gems and pearls, they converted the chalices into drinking cups. Their tables, on which they gamed and feasted, were covered with the pictures of Christ and the saints, and they trampled underfoot the most venerable objects of the Christian worship. In the cathedral of Santa Sophia, the ample veil of the sanctuary was rent asunder for the sake of the golden fringe, and the altar, a monument of art and riches, was broken in pieces and shared among the captors. Their mules and horses were laden with the wrought silver and gilt carvings which they tore down from the doors and pulpit, and if the beasts stumbled under the burden, they were stabbed by their impatient drivers, and the holy pavement streamed with their impure blood. The prostitute was seated on the throne of the patriarch, and that daughter of Belial, as she is styled, sung and danced in the church to ridicule the hymns and processions of the Orientals. Nor were the repositories of the royal dead secure from violation. In the church of the apostles, the tombs of the emperors were rifled, and it is said that after 6 centuries the corpse of Justinian was found without any signs of decay or putrefaction. In the streets the French and Flemings clothed themselves and their horses in painted robes and flowing headdresses of linen, and the coarse intemperance of their feasts insulted the splendid sobriety of the East. To expose the arms of a people of scribes and scholars, they affected to display a pen, an inkhorn, and a sheet of paper, without discerning that the instruments of science and valor were alike feeble and useless in the hands of the modern Greeks. Their reputation and their language encouraged them, however, to despise the ignorance and to overlook the progress of the Latins. In the love of the arts, the national difference was still more obvious and real. The Greeks preserved with reverence the works of their ancestors, which they could not imitate, and in the destruction of the statues of Constantinople, we are provoked to join in the complaints and invectives of the Byzantine historian. We have seen how the rising city was adorned by the vanity and despotism of the imperial founder. In the ruins of paganism, some gods and heroes were saved from the acts of superstition, and the Forum and Hippodrome were dignified with the relics of a better age. Several of these are described by Nicetas in a florid and affected style, and from his descriptions I shall select some interesting particulars. The victorious charioteers were cast in bronze at their own or the public charge, and fitly placed in the hippodrome. They stood aloft in their chariots, wheeling round the goal. The spectators could admire their attitude and judge of the resemblance. And of these figures, the most perfect might have been transported from the Olympic Stadium. The Sphinx, river horse, and crocodile denote the climate and manufacture of Egypt and the spoils of that ancient province. The she-wolf, suckling Romulus and Remus, a subject alike pleasing to the old and the new Romans, but which could really be treated before the decline of the Greek sculpture. An eagle holding and tearing a serpent in his talons, a domestic monument of the Byzantines, which they ascribed not to a human artist, but to the magic power of the philosopher Apollonius, who, by this talisman, delivered the city from such venomous reptiles. An ass and his driver, which were erected by Augustus in his colony of Nicopolis to commemorate a verbal omen of the victory of Actium. An equestrian statue which passed, in the vulgar opinion, for Joshua, the Jewish conqueror, stretching out his hand to stop the course of the descending sun. A more classical tradition recognized the features of Bellerophon and Pegasus, and the free attitude of the steed seemed to mark that he trod on air rather than on the earth. A square and lofty obelisk of brass, the sides were embossed with a variety of picturesque and rural scenes, birds singing, rustics laboring or playing on their pipes, sheep bleating, lambs skipping, the sea and a scene of fish and fishing, little naked cupids laughing, playing and pelting each other with apples, and on the summit a female figure turning with the slightest breath and thence dominated the wind's attendant. The Phrygian shepherd presenting to Venus the prize of beauty, the apple of discord. The incomparable statue of Helen, which is delineated by Nicetas in the words of admiration and love. Her well-turned feet, snowy arms, rosy lips, bewitching smiles, swimming eyes, arched eyebrows, the harmony of her shape, the lightness of her drapery, and her flowing locks that waved in the wind. A beauty that might have moved her barbarian destroyers to pity and remorse. The manly or divine form of Hercules, as he was restored to life by the master hand of Lysippus. Of such magnitude that his thumb was equal to his waist, his leg to the stature of a common man, his chest ample, his shoulders broad, his limbs strong and muscular, his hair curled, his aspect commanding. Without his bow or quiver or club, his lion's skin carelessly thrown over him, he was seated on an osier basket, his right leg and arm stretched to the utmost, his left knee bent and supporting his elbow, his head reclining on his left hand, his countenance indignant and pensive. A colossal statue of Juno, which had once adorned her temple of Samos, the enormous head by four yoke of oxen was laboriously drawn to the palace. Another colossus of Pallas or Minerva, 30 feet in height, and representing with admirable spirit the attributes and character of the martial maid. Before we accuse the Latins, it is just to remark that this palace was destroyed after the first siege by the fear and superstition of the Greeks themselves. The other statues of brass, which I have enumerated, were broken and melted by the unfeeling avarice of the Crusaders. The cost and labour were consumed in a moment. The soul of genius evaporated in smoke, and the remnant of base metal was coined into money for the payment of the troops. Bronze is not the most durable of monuments. From the marble forms of Phidias and Praxiteles, the Latins might turn aside with stupid contempt. But unless they were crushed by some accidental injury, those useless stones stood secure on their pedestals. The most enlightened of the strangers, above the gross and sensual pursuits of their countrymen, more piously exercised the right of conquest in the search and seizure of the relics of the saints. Immense was the supply of heads and bones, crosses and images that were scattered by this revolution over the churches of Europe. And such was the increase of pilgrimage and oblation that no branch, perhaps, of more lucrative plunder was imported from the East. Of the writings of antiquity, many that still existed in the 12th century are now lost. But the pilgrims were not solicitous to save or transport the volumes of an unknown tongue. The perishable substance of paper or parchment can only be preserved by the multiplicity of copies. The literature of the Greeks had almost centered in the metropolis, and without computing the extent of our loss, we may drop a tear over the libraries that have perished in the triple fire of Constantinople. Chapter 61. Partition of the Empire by the French and Venetians. Five Latin emperors of the houses of Flanders and Courtenay. Their wars against the Bulgarians and Greeks. Weakness and poverty of the Latin Empire. Recovery of Constantinople by the Greeks. General consequences of the Crusades. After the death of the lawful princes, the French and Venetians, confident of justice and victory, agreed to divide and regulate their future possessions. It was stipulated by treaty that 12 electors, 6 of either nation, should be nominated, that a majority should choose the Emperor of the East, and that if the votes were equal, the decision of chance should ascertain the successful candidate. To him, with all the titles and prerogatives of the Byzantine throne, they assigned the two palaces of Bucolion and Blakerni, with a fourth part of the Greek monarchy. It was defined that the three remaining portions should be equally shared between the Republic of Venice and the barons of France, that each feudatory, with an honorable exception for the Doge, should acknowledge and perform the duties of homage and military service to the supreme head of the empire, that the nation which gave an emperor should resign to their brethren the choice of a patriarch, and that the pilgrims, whatever might be their impatience to visit the Holy Land, should devote another year to the conquest and defense of the Greek provinces. After the conquest of Constantinople by the Latins, the treaty was confirmed and executed, and the first and most important step was the creation of an emperor. The 6 electors of the French nation were all ecclesiastics, the abbot of Luz, the archbishop-elect of Acre in Palestine, and the bishops of Troyes, Soissons, Halberstadt, and Bethlehem, the last of whom exercised in the camp the office of Pope's legate. Their profession and knowledge were respectable, and as they could not be the objects, they were best qualified to be the authors of the choice. The 6 Venetians were the principal servants of the state, and in this list the noble families of Querini and Contarini are still proud to discover their ancestors. The 12 assembled in the chapel of the palace, and after the solemn invocation of the Holy Ghost, they proceeded